Ney is probably one of the, or the oldest instrument in the world, and it's the simplest instrument. It's made of reed. Different parts of Middle East play ney, but with very different styles. Other than Iran, ney is basically played by putting the instrument next to your lips and mainly making two levels of, I don't think this is on, sound with a limited range. In Iran, about 100 or so years ago, a musician discovered a new way or a different way of playing ney, which is putting the ney between the two front teeth, just a little bit of it, and make a different sound in addition to the other sounds that other cultures make with ney. Ney has no mouthpiece whatsoever, it's just a plain tube. And in Iran we call it haft band, which is seven sections basically. And it goes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 pieces, and the length goes from a longer length gradually to the smaller one. It has six holes, five in front and one in the back, and you have to make 17 notes that make the Iranian octave. There are five quarter notes in addition to the 12 Western notes. And this is mainly made with half fingering, and as you will see, with the lips and the gestures on the face. So once I played for my daughter's school, elementary school, and kids started laughing because they had never seen anyone do that to their class. So from then on, when I played for the kids, I used to turn the lights off, and then they liked it.
Thank you. Dr. Sheikhul Islami. Before we begin with Dr. Sarush's lecture, just a couple announcements. I'm going to pass around a handout. It's from Reynold Nicholson's translation of Masnavi or Mathnavi into English. And also we have a handout from last week. Apparently there were some people who didn't receive the book list that Dr. Sarush compiled. So if you're interested in that, we'll have those available after class. Also, a couple things that are available in case you want a complete list for the classes. You know, we have some flyers up here, an email list in case you would like to get on the list. You can sign up afterwards. And then I left some slips for comments, suggestions, criticisms, and you're more than welcome to, make some notes in that regard as well. Okay, and so I'm going to pass around the handouts, and now I'll hand it over to Dr. Sarush.
Indeed, very grateful to Dr. Zahid for his excellent performance here. And without this, our performance here would have been much more defective. So you made it perfect at least. And I'm sure that our audience here would appreciate it. And the raving and the intoxicating effect of Ney, now you are experiencing it. When he was playing this, I was just, things was crossing in my mind about Rumi and how Ney was being played in his meetings with his disciples, friends, and how he got his, impressions and his symbolisms and the meaning that he gave to the idea of the reed and the musics of the flute and all of that. Actually, we are going to discuss some of those this time. And so this excellent performance gives us a very suitable prelude to what we are going to do this evening. Now, the title of my talk this time is The Imagery of Reed. And this imagery is so prominent in whole Rumi's work and poetry that it deserves to be discussed at least in an hour in order to see what he has seen in the reed and the musics of the flute. And he has got to teach us through this important imagery or symbolism. We will see that there are a number of images being used and employed by Rumi in his work, but none is like the ney or reed or the flute that is the most important one actually among all others. all of us are aware that the main goal of a Sufi, of a mystic, is to reach a sort of union with his God. And this union is the goal, the objective, and the meaning of his life. So all these imageries and symbolisms actually serve the same purpose in order to tell us what is our relationship with our God, how are we to visualize it, to see it, to perceive it, and how are we to materialize it, to realize it, and to reach that desirable union or reunion, perhaps, with our Creator. So in Persian poetry and in all Islamic culture, I would say, Rumi is the person who has used the imagery of the reed. All other poets and writers, they have got their own images, their own symbols, in order to describe and interpret the relationship of man and God. But for Rumi, reed or ney is the main symbol. We will see what he sees in this symbol and how it is to be interpreted. I touched upon some points last time about the reed, and this time I'm going to complete what we saw in the last meeting. Now, let me finish an incomplete story of how Masnavi was written or was performed or was produced by Rumi. Actually, what I said so far was that he didn't, in a literal sense of the word, write the poems. Actually, he performed them, he recited them, he uttered them, and so there were disciples and friends around him taking note, taking down what he said, and most probably he never edited what he said and what he did, because he was always, as I said, fresh. He never went back to the past, and he never wanted to think about what he had thought or he had produced before. So he had always, he was looking into the future rather than in the past. In a sense, actually, he forgot what he said in the past. And you will see, as I said, you never see in the whole Masnavi where he says or refers us to what he had said previously. So always he's producing a new thing, and without any pre-planning. As I said, there is no plan, and as the imagery which I used in the first session, the book is circular, it is not linear, in the sense that it is like a circle. Every point on it is the beginning point and the end point. So there is no beginning and no end to the book. You can open the book from wherever you like and just start reading it without losing anything, you see. So therefore you can read it on and on, again and again. It is like inspirational revelatory books. And indeed it was a product of some sort of revelation. And Rumi himself is not shy to tell us that there is a revelation, inspiration behind all this. And but he said that out of politeness, Sufis never use the word revelation or wahy. They only use the word of, not the wahy of God, so they use the word of the revelation of heart, wahyadil. But he says, I mean, all these are the same, roughly, and therefore it is a revelatory work. In that sense, you would see that there are repetitions in the book, but these repetitions are not boring at all, because in every time, in every case, you will see a different aspect, a different angle of the same thing, of the same story, and so on and so forth. Now, but the spirit of the whole book, of course, is the business of separation and reunion with God. And all these are pretexts in order to tell the same story again and again. At the end of the first story of the book one, he says, listen to this story, because that is actually the story of us. بشنوید ای دوستان این داستان خود حقیقت نقد حال ماست آن. It is actually our business that we are telling you through the story after the story. Therefore, stories are different, but the meaning and the sense and the life and the spirit of the stories, if you like, are always the same, the story of the union and reunion, and how to visualize best the relationship between man and God, between the Lord and the servant, between the Creator and the created, between the boundless, the formless, the infinite and the finite, and the if you like, the formful creatures. Now, in order to finish our previous story, I want just to, if you have got the handouts, please, look into the page 216. These are the last words of the book 1. Okay, 216, you have got it. And here you will see how the book ends, and it tells you very vividly, very clearly, that there has been no plan and a very unexpected event, which Rumi is not going to tell us what exactly has actually terminated the book one. And the stories have it that there was a 2 years gap between the book one and the book two. Then again, we are not sure what was the reason or the cause behind this gap, but something we can actually find in what Rumi has got to tell us, and we are going to read it. Now, it is, at the, what is it, this 3990, yes, the verse 3990, you will see, "Oh, alas, two mouthfuls were eaten, and thereby the ferment of thought was frozen up." Now, we are not sure what was two mouthfuls, and what really happened to Rumi. But what he tells us is something had happened to him. And that must be a kind of material, some sort of lust, some sort of inappropriate action that he might have done. Something which was not appropriate for a Sufi to do. Eating too much, something. So what he says actually is two mouthfuls were eaten, and thereby the ferment of thought was frozen up. So he was not able anymore to continue with performing the Masnavi. Now, see his reaction to this. First of all, actually he admits this, and what he tells us is that the inspiration now is frozen up, is no longer coming to him. So he is without any aid. And things remain frozen in his mind or in his heart. So his reaction is important. Next page, 217, you will see, "It has become mixed with earth," means the water that comes up from the well. "It has become mixed with the earth and dry and flesh cutting. Abstain now from the herbage, O camel. The words are coming forth very earth soiled. The water has become turbid. Stop up the mouth of the well, that God may again make it pure and sweet, that he who made it turbid may likewise make it pure. Patience brings the object of desire, not haste. Have patience, and God knows best what is right." So he had patience. So he just waited. He didn't do anything. He didn't push himself or force himself in order to produce more poems after poems. He didn't do that. Because producing these poems, as I said, was not in a sense voluntary to him. He just poured out what came to his heart, what came to his mind. He didn't try perhaps to to take care of the rhymes and the rhythms and things of the poems. Because in one place he says that, "I am thinking of rhymes, but my beloved tells me, think only of me, don't think of the rhymes." So that was what actually went on in his heart, in his soul. So his reaction was this, that now that the water is turbid, according to him, the main thing to be done is just patience. Wait and be patient until the God, the one who made it turbid, makes it pure again. Now, this is the end of the first book. So the lapse between the two, as I said, was 2 years. The stories tell us that it was because of the death of the wife of Husamuddin, who was the main addressee of the book. So that may have happened. I mean, there is nothing wrong with that, but it is very, very impossible, very improbable, that very unlikely that Rumi had stopped actually writing poems or performing his Masnavi because of the death of the wife of Husamuddin. Some other things must have happened, and that some other thing is clear from what he said, two mouthfuls of something he had eaten that had frozen up the well of the inspiration in his soul. So he had to be patient until the inspiration resumes and comes to him again. And so after 2 years, now he was ready to start again. So at the beginning of the second book, Now we read this. Then that is in page 222. You have got it. they are not in a good order, so you have just go through all pages in order to find 222. Okay, you've got it all. Now this is the beginning page of the second book of the book 2 of Masnavi. In the name of God, the Merciful, the Compassionate. This Masnavi has been delayed for a while. An interval was needed in order that the blood might turn to milk. Blood does not become sweet milk until thy fortune gives birth to a new baby. Hearken well to my words. Okay, you see what he says here. Let me read you the Persian. There are again Persian students here who may want to hear the original version of what Rumi says. مدتی این مسنوی تأخیر شد مهلتی بایست تا خون شیر شد تا نزاید بخت تو فرزند نو خون نگردد شیر شیرین خوش شنو. Now what he tells us about the blood and the milk and how the blood turns into milk. It needs at least 9 months for a baby, for the blood of the mother, in order to be turned into milk. Therefore, according to Rumi, so the well of the milk, so to speak, had dried up. So it needed some time in order to be turned into milk. I used the expression that Husamuddin, his main disciple, who was the main addressee of the Masnavi, and who was actually a replacement of Shams to Rumi, I used the expression that he milked Rumi, and without him there would have been no Masnavi at all. I mean, Rumi actually found him the best person to be addressed, the best person to be intimate to his secrets, actually, to be confided to. And therefore, Husamuddin had a very big role in the whole creation of this great work. Now, when he says that my blood is turning into milk because of you, and it needed a lapse of some time in order for the body or for the soul to be ready again to produce milk, he says more than what is apparent in these words. First of all, the very idea of producing a poem, that is the most important thing. In some other places, not in Masnavi, in his Divan, he tells us about the imagery about the turning blood into ink. That is even more telling. You see, turning خون چو می جوشد منش از شعر رنگی می دهم. My blood is boiling and I am turning it into ink. In the sense that and that is exactly what you hear it from some of the modern poets, that the art of poetry is the suffering of turning blood into ink. Now that is what Rumi actually has got to say, and this means that all these words actually comes out from the depth of his heart, from the depth of his soul. He was not, as I said, forcing himself artificially in order to produce something. Here when he says that in order for the blood to turn into milk you need some time, take it very seriously. It is his blood that you see, that you meet in the pages of Masnavi. It is not only his thoughts. It is not his mind that was working when he was producing this. It was his whole blood, his whole soul that was at work, moving and acting and pouring out on the pages, turning blood into milk or turning blood into ink. Now, so perhaps this gap between the book 1 and book 2 appeared again for the blood to turn into milk again, and so he started off and he ran non-stop for 10 years to produce 5 other books of Masnavi. Therefore the first book, which took him 2 years, and then 2 years lapse, and then 10 years. So the whole Masnavi, as I said before, is the child of 14 years of life of Rumi, and he didn't actually stop, but death stopped him. So he had to become silent, and that was at the end of his life. So this is actually the story of the book and the Masnavi, how it was created and how it was conducted by Rumi. There are a lot to be said in this respect, but let us leave it at that and come to the imagery of the reed. Now, we read the two verses of the beginning of the book 1 in the last session. We have got it in mind, we come back to it again, but I would like you to see some other images or imageries that Rumi actually uses with respect to our relationship with God. Let us see, and then we will actually find and understand the force of the imagery of reed. And then, of course, I will go to offer some explanations for this. Now, come to the page 35. In the page 35, of course, this is a piece of a big story. I'm not going to tell you that story. It is the story of a minister, a vizier, as Nicholson has put it. According to some Islamic mythology, I would say, a Jew actually corrupted the whole Christian faith. Now, what Rumi actually is telling us in this story is the story of that Jew, vizier or minister, who corrupted the Christian faith. So we are not actually concerned with the story itself. So forget about this this vizier and so on. Come to this page 35. From the third verse, I'm reading you. We are as the harp. Okay, found it? We are as the harp, and thou art striking with the plectrum. The lamentation is not from us. It is thou that art making lamentation. We are as the flute, and the music in us is from thee. We are as the mountain, and the echo in us is from thee. We are as pieces of chess engaged in victory and defeat. Over victory and defeat is from thee, O thou whose qualities are comely. Who are we, O thou soul of souls, that we should remain in being beside thee? We and our existence are really non-existences. Thou art the absolute being which manifests the appreciable. Well, I mean, according to my translation, which looks like a appreciable thing. Now, this is the choice of Nicholson. The Persian version is ma adam ha'i muhasti ha'i ma tu wujud mutlaqi fani numa. It depends on the word to take it as a transitive or the intransitive word. Now, Nicholson has taken it as a transitive verb, so manifest appreciable. But if you take it intransitive, which to me is more meaningful, then we have to translate it into you or thou art the absolute being which looks perishable, looks mortal, something. which manifests the perishable, causes phenomena to appear. Now, we all are lions, but lions on a banner. Because of the wind, they are rushing onward from moment to moment. Their onward rush is visible, and the wind is unseen. May that which is unseen not fail from us. Our wind and our being are of thy gift. Our whole existence is from the bringing us into being. So it goes on. Now you see that there are a number of images here. The lion and the banner, the flute and the music, the mountain and the echo, the harp and performing or playing with the harp, and so on and so forth. In some other places you will see many other images like this. Only one of them here is the flute and the music, or the reed and the blowing into the reed, and there are many others. Now, who is thou? Of course, is God. No, he's addressing God. He's talking to him, and he's trying to show us how are we related to him, and what sort of perception of the connection between us and him we should have. All the imageries actually serve the purpose of telling us that we are nothing, absolutely nothing. We are void, we are empty, we have nothing from us. And everything comes to us from God, the blowing, the sense, the life, the existence. So he takes and adopts various images in order to convey the message. One of these things is the mountain and the echo. Now, I think the most pictorial one is the lion and the wind. Maybe you have seen the banners or the flags on which there are lions. This is, of course, the official banner or flag of the Iranian dynasties. So, because, as you know, lion is the king of the animals, according to the myth. So it was very appropriate, very suitable for the kings in order to choose and to use the image of the lion on the banner, on the official flag of the country, of the kingdom, and so on. So when they used the image or the picture of a lion on the banner, it meant that it belongs to a king. Now, when Rumi actually used this, it was very familiar to his audience. Now, he said that we are all lions. We are very proud of ourselves, that we are lions, we are courageous, we are powerful, and we are the kings of the animal kingdom, and so on and so forth. But we are the lions on the banners. Now, it seems that we move. It seems that perhaps we attack somebody, but all comes from the wind behind us. Since the wind is blowing, now the banner moves, and it seems that as if the lion was moving and attacking someone, and as if she had the life and the power and the will to attack and to move. One of the aptest images in order to tell us that apparently, ostensibly, we are something, but really we are nothing. We are just the lifeless pictures. If there is no blowing of the wind of God, we are nothing, and we can do nothing by ourselves. So this is this. But then, of course, the imagery of reed is much more important, because that tells us a lot more. Of course, this helplessness, lifelessness, motionlessness, everything is there in the imagery of lion and wind and banner. All those you have got. But something you do not have it there, and that is the idea of the form and formlessness and boundlessness and the idea of the of the wind or the power being determined by the instrument that you use it. Lion on the banner is not an instrument, but Rumi actually is looking for something which is absolutely an instrument, has got no function of itself, and it has to be in the hand of somebody else in order to become live. Without somebody else playing with it, using it, employing it, it has no function, no life. It is a useless piece of matter. there he finds, I mean, in reed imagery, he finds all these aspects, all these dimensions. And because of this, actually, reeds come to help him a lot, and to give him the best symbol to convey all his messages. Now, okay, you saw here the piece of the reed of Ney we played. As I said, I mean, by itself, the reed is nothing. Has no voice, has no music, and has no life. So there is always somebody behind it in order to blow into it, in order to breathe into it, to make it live. So everything in the world, including human beings, of course, are like this. And so next, I mean, the another idea is the, which is, I think, the most important one in this respect, is the idea of the boundlessness of the air, the idea of formlessness of the air. Let us know this, and let us have it in mind, and when I'm speaking about God next time, I will elaborate on this. For Rumi, I mean, God is formless, okay? Is absolutely formless, in the sense that he is unconceptualizable. Not because we cannot conceptualize it, not because of our shortcomings, because of his objective existence. He is beyond any concept. He is beyond any opposites. Even his unity, of course, Rumi was a devout Muslim. He was a monotheist. And he believed, I mean, very firmly in the unity of God. But the unity of God is not a numerical unity, according to him, according to most of Muslim theologians. He is even beyond numbers. And that's why they use the word true unity of God, rather than the numerical unity of God. You see? Because when you say the numerical unity, that means that, of course, you have got number one, you have got number two, you have got one, two, and things like that. So because of this, in order to avoid this kind of impression, this kind of conceptualization, they use the word true unity, which is beyond numbers, beyond all opposites, beyond everything. So air, which is being blown into the reed, breathed into the reed, is the best example in the world in order to give you the impression of something which is boundless, which is formless. And then, of course, it is the reed, it is the ney that forms it, gives it the form, gives it the shape, gives it the determination. And here again you see that the relationship between the two, and the things that the imagery of reed can give us, but the imagery of the lion and the banner cannot, and the mountain and the echo cannot. But all these, of course, have got something to tell us. But then there is another dimension to the imagery of reed, and that is the idea of the breath, of the breathing of God into the world, and especially into human beings. There is a magic here. I'm going to read you one of the verses of Quran. There, of course, you see that according to Quran, which Rumi no doubt was very familiar with it, and as I said, there are maybe 4,000 allusions to Quran in the whole Masnavi. So this means that he was so immersed in Quranic culture that just came out from his mouth without any deliberation. There you see that God tells us that we breathed into human beings our soul, which has been subject to many interpretations. First of all, what is the breath of God? Secondly, what is the soul of God? Now that we have got it, and I'm going to read you, I mean, only there are in a number of places in Quran, but now this is in the chapter 15 of Quran, that just in order to give you an idea of what is there. Now, and remember when thy Lord said unto the angels, I am creating a mortal out of potter's clay, of dark mud altered. So when I have made him and have breathed unto him of my spirit, do you fall down, prostrating yourself unto him. So the angels fell prostrate, all of them together, save Iblis, i.e. Satan. He refused to be among the prostrate. So God has breathed into us from his spirit. This is actually Rumi, what Rumi did was he took this idea of breathing of God into human beings. So he blended it and mixed it with the idea of music, which he so loved it. So now the product is this, that we are as if the reeds next to the lips of God. He is always breathing in us. And this breathing was not only for the Adam of a father or forefather, it is in every one of us, actually. And it was not in the beginning of the creation of mankind, it is continuous. He is always breathing into his creatures, especially in human beings. So that is the magic that works.